Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is May 25th, 2017. And today, we're going to be talking with leading market analyst and commentator Lance Roberts. As this is being recorded, stocks are powering to new all-time highs, signaling, well, what exactly? That's what we're here to find out today. CNBC and the Wall Street Journal and other market cheerleaders want you to believe that everything is awesome. But are things really awesome? So let's find out. Lance, hey, he's one of my favorite market analysts and commentators. He has a background of 25 years of private banking and investment management. Lance is currently a silent partner for an RIA in Houston, Texas. The majority of his time is spent analyzing, researching, and writing commentary about investing, investor psychology, very important today, and macro views of the markets and the economy. His thoughts are not generally mainstream, and that's why I'm going to love talking with him here today. You're going to love him as well. He is also the chief strategist and economist for Clarity Financial, editor of realinvestmentadvice.com, and the talk show host of The Lance Roberts Show at KSEV 700. Hey, he publishes very regularly on Seeking Alpha as well. Real pleasure to have him on. Let's welcome you. Lance, welcome to the program.
Absolutely happy to be here.
First, is there anything else about your background I might have missed that will help our listeners know who you are, where you're coming from?
No, well, you know, it's interesting. I started my entire career as I was managing a deposit CD book for a bank in Austin, Texas. And I started 3 days before the crash of 87. And my boss had me entirely convinced the entire crash was my fault. And so after that, our bank eventually got bought by NCNB, which was North Carolina National Bank, eventually became Nations Bank. And we were bought and closed down along with the rest of the acquisitions. And I wound up overseas managing money for high net worth investors out of Monaco and several other countries. And, you know, what I learned there was fed a lot into my overall background and my thought process about managing money, which is not losing it, conservation of principal, mm-hmm. the management of risk. And while markets can do things that are totally illogical at times, there is one thing that is always the same, which is this time is never different. And once again, I hear way too much right now that because of central banks, because of this, because of that, this time is different. And it's not. And eventually, what goes up does come down. There's this simple thing called a full market cycle. And while we've enjoyed a very brilliant first 8 years, going on to 9 years of the first half of a market cycle, there will be payback. And those paybacks are fast, swift, sharp, and totally unexpected. And everything that people are building into their belief structure about earnings growth, et cetera, can be reversed literally on a dime when something unexpected happens.
Well, now let's talk about that full market cycle, because you recently penned a piece. I saw it on Seeking Alpha on the 5 universal laws of human investment stupidity. I loved it. I think investors are being especially dumb here. As context, I follow, I've met, I know him, and I agree with pretty much everything John Hussman says. Great guitar player, by the way. Good voice, too.
That's right.
And I'm such an adherent to his views for two reasons. One, you already mentioned one of them, it's never different this time. And two, he's got the data. He's got the historical rigor to back up what he says. And according to him, investors are not paying very good attention to history here. Do you agree with him on those counts, or have any other reasons to think maybe people are being dumb here?
Well, so first of all, it's always interesting. I have a great respect for John Hussman. We communicate regularly on different issues. We've had dialogues back and forth on particular issues about fundamentals and valuations, et cetera. You know, people tend to immediately discredit anything that he has to say simply because they go look at the performance of his particular fund or whatever it is. Or they look at his writings and say, well, he's been wrong. He's just been wrong for so long that he's just wrong now. You know, the problem is that, as you stated, his work and his research is based on very careful analytical analysis. And he goes through the data, he looks at the underlying structures, and he makes very well-crafted arguments as to whatever the particular issues that he's covering. But most importantly, when talking about valuations and forward returns, the data is clear. And this time isn't different than it was previously. Just lately, you always start to see towards the end of a particular bull market cycle, people coming up with new excuses. If you remember back in 99, it was, well, you know, if you're trying to invest like Warren Buffett, that's like driving Dad's old Pontiac. You know, this is all about eyeballs per page. And what we found out was, is that, no, it's not about eyeballs per page. It's about how much dollars you're actually putting down onto your bottom line. In 2007, it was different this time because we were in a quote unquote Goldilocks economy. The Fed had it all under control. Subprime mortgages were contained. They weren't. And today, what we're seeing is a very different type of bubble forming that is completely trying to exclude valuations once again. And at the bottom line of this is what we pay for something today is based upon the future cash flows and expectations of corporations over the long term and as to how we get paid back. Well, now it's, well, don't even worry about that. Just buy an ETF, be a passive indexer. And we're now creating this new bubble inside of ETFs and this whole passive indexing, you know, mentality. And very similarly to what we've seen in the past, we're ignoring and we're making excuses. Oh, well, this time is different because, you know, valuations have been elevated for the last 10 years. So the median long-term valuation no longer matters at 15 times earnings. You know, it's now 19 times earnings. So we're really not that overvalued. It's all okay. It'll all be fine. Just hold on and things will work out. Well, just remember that at 19 or 20 or 25 times earnings, that means that a dollar invested today, if you capture 100% of the earnings that are distributed by the companies, it will take you 25 years to get your money back. That's the problem. And when you look at valuations where they are today, over the next 10 years or 20 years, just as John Hussman has shown multiple times, your returns are going to be close to zero.
Close to zero. And of course, this time is never really different, but let's talk about ways that it might be actually a little bit different. Big article in the Wall Street Journal last week about the rise of the quants, and I don't know if everybody saw it, but a quant is somebody who uses math and writes algorithms so that computers can do the trading for you. And we now all know that the market structure, something I've been commenting on for many years, particularly through the work of Arnuzzi and others like that, that we have a very different market now. And it's subject to flash crashes and microsecond trading and co-location of servers and all this and that. Lance, is this market really one where we can historically look back and say, here's how markets should behave, here's how they do behave, or is there something fundamentally different in the market structure now?
Fundamentally, no, there's nothing different. Because remember, fundamentals are, at the end of the day, about valuations, earnings, those type of things. Technically, the market is different today because of all the reasons you just laid out in terms of quantitative trading, computerized trading, etc. You know, what we see are two things that are happening in particular that people should be paying attention to. One, as I mentioned earlier, this herding into ETFs now has created a dislocation between the underlying realities of what's happening inside of individual stocks, because as people pile into ETFs, it requires stocks like Facebook and Amazon and Google to be bought. And so we're starting to get this detachment between what's actually happening with the underlying liquidity of the stocks versus what's happening with the ETFs. There's going to be ultimately, I wrote an article about this called about passive indexing just recently, that when this breaks, whenever it breaks, and it will break, that people make an assumption that there's always a buyer for every seller in the markets. Now, that's absolutely true. And this is often the argument that's given by the mainstream media. They go, for every buyer, there's a seller. So it doesn't matter when the market turns, you know, you'll be okay. But you won't, because at some point there is a buyer for every seller, but it's always the question at what price. And because of all the piling into these ETFs, that when the market eventually breaks, there will be a buyer, but that buyer could be percentages down much lower where that buyer initially appears. And we'll see a very rapid break in the market, and a vacuum will appear in prices. And the gap down will be so sharp and so fast that it not only paralyzes most investors who are now going to start hoping that they'll get a little bit of recovery to sell into, but then we'll start triggering margin calls. And there's been numerous articles written about margin debt. Margin debt's not a problem. Don't worry about margin debt. It's fine. Margin debt is not fine. We're at record levels of margin debt, but it's like a can of gasoline. And if I set a can of gasoline in the middle of a room and nobody touches it, it's fine. Nothing happens. It's inert. Drop a match into that can of gasoline, and you've got an entirely different story. So the only thing that's missing at this moment right now is we've got this herding of individuals into a specific type of investment. Just like dot-com stocks, just like real estate stocks, we now have people herding into ETFs. This is now being driven, back to your point, about quantitative trading. So all these computers are basically acting on the same set of information, pushing stocks in the same direction, because they're all working off the same set of information. So this is like a tanker of gasoline, and somebody's going to drop a stick of dynamite into it, because when this all reverses, you have a these passive indexers become panic sellers, and then that begins to immediately trigger a reversal in the algorithms, which all feed on themselves in a negative direction, and the gap that opens up will make the gap in the Lehman crisis appear minor.
Now, let's talk about this, because it's such a fascinating market structure, something to understand. Maybe you can help me understand this, because I looked at it and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was on Zero Hedge a while back that showed that the number of ways to engage with stocks through something like an ETF. So an ETF, for those listening, is a basket that's meant to track the underlying share of stocks. So you might buy an ETF in the S&P 500. As the S&P goes up, this ETF goes up. And the way they do that is they couple the ETF to the underlying shares. There are now apparently more ETFs and vehicles like that than there are individual shares. Did you see that piece
Absolutely.
Of data? Of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So help us understand that, because to my unsophisticated way of thinking, it means that let's just make it simple. I'll make the math simple so I can work this out in my head. If there are 1,000 different shares type companies out there with listed ticker symbols, and there are 1,500 ETFs out there, it means that there's basically 1.5-to-1 representation. It means that as these people start to sell these ETFs, there's going to be more selling than there is actually shares outstanding. If I haven't butchered that too badly, it means that there's actually leverage on the number of shares that are outstanding that will all have to be rectified, both, I guess, on the way up and the way down.
Well, that's right. And this is why you see, and if you take a look at a lot of shares in the market, the individual stocks. So step aside from the ETFs for a moment and go look at what's happening with some of the underlying individual stocks that are in these baskets. And you're seeing more, what we would consider to be more abnormal movements in the stock. And it's because of this, exactly as you stated, and said exactly the right way, is that you're getting this leverage of buyers, because as one buyer goes in to buy an ETF, then if that one marginal buyer is effectively buying 1.5 times of the stock that is actually being purchased by the purchase of the ETF, then you leverage that with the fact that you've got a lot of these ETFs that are using option structures in order to leverage those ETFs. So now you've got options on top of the leverage on top of the stock. So this is this is back to our original point about this quant-driven market. The information flow into the market is all bullishly biased. And these algorithms, where they're looking at, you know, political headlines or geopolitical headlines or stock trading headlines or company headlines, whatever it is that's driving these algorithms, all these algorithms are all basically matched up and they're all trading off the information in exactly the same way. This is what happened a couple of Wednesdays ago when the headlines hit about James Comey and the potential that there might have been an obstruction of justice. What you saw was a very rapid decline in the market, almost 1.5% in one day. And this is the beginning of those reversals. Now, fortunately, right after that, the headlines cleared and algorithms went back to work. But there will be a point to where once these algorithms trip, they will hit major support points. When those support leverage levels are hit, that will trigger more selling, so forth and so on. And as we were talking about earlier, the thing that happens with the individual investor, and this is the difference, individual investors have been lulled into this sense of complacency that simply not every dip is a buying opportunity and every opportunity for a dip is just something not to worry about. It's all fine. There's this very high level of complacency that's been drilled into them by both the Federal Reserve and by the media and by the market action in and of itself. But at some point, when that reverses and that decouples and things begin to run in reverse, it will happen so rapidly that investors will be trapped into a paralysis where they are simply trying to make the justification like, well, as soon as it comes back, I'll sell, but it won't come back and it'll go lower. Well, as soon as it gets back to where it was, I'll sell, but it won't get back to that level. It'll go lower. And eventually they'll get to the point to where they're simply just, okay, well, I'm here where I am. I'm just going to sell everything now. And typically that's the bottom of the market.
Now, we've had a lot of conjecture out there, including recently by Asher Edelman saying that he has no doubt that the PPT is behind the market rally and all of this and that. But you know, it seemed odd to me that remember January 2016, everything was kind of going bad, right? Emerging markets are blowing up and the dollar spiking, and there was a lot of chaos out there. And January was pretty awkward. February just all turned around. And then we had Brexit just a few months later in that same spring, and about 3 weeks of confusion, but then things turned around. And then we had what I thought was really a black swan moment, was Trump being elected. Like that was not really on my radar screen as realistic until about 10:30 that night. And remember, we had the Dow down 800-900 points and then turned around in a couple hours and went the other way. Do you think those are the kinds of moments where, you know, Mr. Adelson is, not to put words in his mouth, do you think, is that what he's looking at? Or is he saying more in general, like, are people starting to suspect the entire, you know, advance of the market at all moments now?
It's not the individual. The individual player is very, very small relative to the markets today. There's actually a very good article out just today talking about the number of people in the population of the country. You know, you take a look at the statistics. 80% of Americans have less than $500 in the bank. The average American 401k balance is less than 1 year's salary. American consumer debt just hit all-time highs, and you know, and wages are continuing to remain stagnant. People are living just really for the bulk of America. They're really living kind of paycheck to paycheck. So it's not the individual player that's in the markets driving the markets in any direction. What we're talking about here is we're talking about institutions. We're talking about hedge funds, and most importantly, we're talking about central banks. I track the central bank changes on a four-week moving average for the Federal Reserve. And I've gone back and I've traced this back over time. And you can go back and look at the lows that we saw in early 2016. And immediately at the lows, when we were hitting the lows in February of 2016, Janet Yellen made a call to the ECB and to the Bank of England. The next day, the markets turned around and started climbing higher. And that was the end of that sell-off. When we go and look at Brexit, we go and look at the election of Donald Trump, what we see there is that while the Fed's balance sheet hasn't grown, it's been flatline. What happens, though, is that all these reserves, so as bonds mature on the Fed's balance sheet and interest payments come in, they reserve those in cash. And then at opportune moments, they come in and they redeploy that cash. And you can see, if you zoom in on the Fed's balance sheet, you can see the wiggles from 1 week to the next week about what's happening within the balance sheet. And they line up almost perfectly with market bottoms. Whenever there's a market bottom, you'll see the Fed come in and start redeploying the capital that's been accumulated on their balance sheet. So their balance sheet size is not changing. That's why it's flatline. But it's the difference between the cash roll-off and the reinvestment of that. And that's one thing they were talking about this week with their Fed minutes, is that coming up later this year, J.P. Morgan thinks that it'll happen sometime in maybe September, that they'll start reducing that reinvestment. See, that's extraction of liquidity from the market. And you couple that with higher interest rates, now you're actually talking about tightening money flows into the market, tightening and really kind of starting to slow the economy a bit. And I'm not sure that works out really well for investors, but there's a direct correlation between what central banks are doing and the market responses.
Well, that's fascinating, and I hadn't thought to track the wiggles like that, and that makes a lot of sense. And just a piece of information that's always been odd to me, and I can't go any further with it because nobody will answer this, but we know that the Chicago Mercantile Exchange has a central bank preferred incentive buying program, which is a program reserved for its highest volume participants. So apparently central banks are buying enough stuff on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which are all leveraged products for the people listening. These are options and futures primarily, and we're in the commodities and we're in equities and bonds. So So we know central banks are in there. I've scoured their balance sheets. I've scoured the minutes, the footnotes. I can't find a single central bank that will admit to owning a single CME product, but they're in there. So I don't know how to put those two dots together, but it makes me, curious about what's going on there.
Well, I don't think there's any great secret here. I don't think there's any great conspiracy. We know that just since the beginning of this year, central banks have injected more than $1 trillion into the markets just this year. The differential between the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank and Bank of Japan is that without a congressional charter change, the Federal Reserve cannot buy stocks. They can only buy government-guaranteed issuances, which are Ginnie Mae bonds and U.S. Treasuries. But of course, how that money winds, when they buy those bonds, the way that money winds up into the market is basically they are crediting the reserve accounts of banks who then take that capital and say, well, I can either loan Chris money for 30 years at 3.5% and maybe he'll pay me back on a mortgage, or I can just go invest it into highly liquid commoditized investments where I get a huge amount of leverage, i.e. oil futures, yen, yen-denominated bonds, etc. This is what's called the yen carry trade, and that flows immediately into the financial markets, and that's where we get this continued lift. And it's and back to our original point that brought this up is if you will notice, there's always a very interesting pattern that exists. We'll break a major level of support that historically, when you break a 50-day moving average or you break a previous bottom of support in the markets, generally the markets will fall to the next support level where you may find some buyers. And what we've seen in particular over the last several years is that the markets will break a level of support and magically will just start getting buying coming out of nowhere at points where normally you would not see that happen. And I think the example of the election night is really key, because I was down at Fox. We were doing election coverage that night on Fox, and we were watching the futures as more and more states fell in Trump's favor, which honestly nobody believed was going to happen. But as more and more states fell to the favor of Trump, well, futures kept getting worse and worse and worse. We were down 800, 900 points. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, tomorrow morning is going to be a bloodbath. By the time I got up in the morning, we're almost even, and then we're positive right out of the gate. And it was this flood of liquidity that came in where normally you would have not expected that to occur. And I don't think normally it would have happened under more normal circumstances had you not had the influence of central banks coming in to support markets to keep the deterioration from happening.
So let's I can actually put myself in their shoes and say, I get it, right? So they can't afford a big downturn at some point in time, and there's been a lot of commentary about how the Fed and other central banks have really gotten themselves into a corner where they've built markets to such a level they can't afford to have them fall. So they can't let them fall. But under that strategy, there has to be some sort of guiding principle. And that, I think, always was, hey, growth is going to come back at some point. But let's be honest, we're friends here. So growth is missing. It's missing in action, has been on the global stage for more than a decade at this point. We are subpar, subtrend, full capacity, however you want to measure it. And it doesn't seem to be able to get up off the carpet at this point in time. And the United States, we're always looking at, oh, well, we're going to have a first half recovery, then a second half recovery, then I guess a third half recovery. They keep going, and every time we keep pulling in these weak returns, is there a point, Lance, where the central banks finally go, this isn't working, we have to try something else? Or are they locked into this regime until will the beatings continue until morale improves?
I think you hit the nail on the head. One of the best examples to look at as far as the country, and people quickly dismiss this, and I think it's wrong, is to look at Japan. Japan's been trapped in this low growth rate, rolling recession type environment with subprime interest rates now for over 25 years. But what similarities do they have versus the United States? And this is where people quickly dismiss the Japan comparison. Say, well, it's Japan. It's an island. It's over there, and it has nothing to do with us. But they have an aging demographic problem. They have a very low birth rate. They have a massively underfunded pension system with a massive amount of people that are drawing off of it. And you take a look at every economic environment that they have in Japan, we have very many of the same things here. We have the lowest birth rate since the 1940s of new children coming into our economy. We have an aging demographic with the baby boomers. We have more multi-generational families living with each other since the Great Depression. 30% of the millennials are still living with parents after graduating college. You know, these all have an impact on economic growth. And so, to your point, we continue to lug along here at 2% growth. And very interestingly, while the Bureau of Economic Analysis has tried to rejigger and recalculate economic growth in the first quarter, they keep adjusting the seasonal adjustments to try to adjust up first quarter's economic growth. And it still comes in weak because, you know, we have cold weather during the winter. So they keep adjusting for cold weather, which we already have existing. And then we have this recovery in the second and third quarter, and then we roll off again in the fourth quarter and the first quarter. And this has been the cycle, and it's been a very evident kind of restocking cycle. We're just restocking enough to get through the next two couple of quarters, and then we start this whole process over again. And it's been this consistent ebb and flow really ever since 2009. And that hasn't changed. And we take a look at the employment numbers, and yes, we've created tons of jobs, but we've created all these jobs. We have the lowest jobless claims since the 1970s, but yet we don't have any type of real wage growth. And you take a look at the consumptive side of the equation, where people are buying and consuming. 70% of our economy is personal consumption expenditures, yet that really isn't showing any track of growing on a strong basis year over year, despite the fact that everybody supposedly that has a job wants a job. But of course, we get into the real numbers and we start looking at the number of people that are their prime working age between 25 and 54 that should be working. Only half those people are working. So there's the real issues economically. And to your point and to your question, which is, yes, this whole premise behind quantitative easing and this kind of injection of capital was supposed to do one thing and one thing only. It was supposed to lift asset prices temporarily to get consumers confident about the economy. When they get confident about the economy, they're going to start spending, which is going to create the virtuous cycle in the economy of creating demand for businesses. Then the businesses need to hire more and deploy more capital to meet the demand. That puts more people to work, and we have this virtuous cycle of the economy is working. Then the Fed backs off, raises interest rates a little bit, gets off of zero, and everything's worked out. Well, that was supposed to happen in the first 2 years of doing this. We're now 9 years into this program and are in no better position than we were 9 years ago. And here's the danger, is that there is an endpoint to this, to where the economy is going to start correcting regardless. Economic cycles are not indefinite. They are finite. And we may be very well already seeing the very early signs of economic deterioration and the end of this current economic cycle. And with the Fed still near zero in terms of their interest rate policy, and then, of course, with their monetary policy already kind of running full steam ahead globally, there's really a lot less ability and a lot less efficiency in these quantitative programs than what we saw previously. So the bang for the buck the next time we have a recession may be very limited, and that allows for that recession to be much worse than had they backed out of this program 4 or 5 years ago, let the economy have a secondary recession like we did in the late 70s and late 70s, where we had back-to-back recessions. Let the economy work through its debt revulsion, get the economy back on track, and then help along the way. Now the problem is they've gone so far for so long, there's no option to assist when the next recession comes.
What a fantastic answer. And it makes me think immediately that, there are certain economists that I do like to follow. One of them, Steve Keen, and he makes the point that, hey, look, it's one thing to measure this side of the equation, but there's two sides on a balance sheet. And so maybe you should look at debt as well. And so you mentioned some of these components before, that household debt now at an all-time new record, even though we've got median wages, real wages that are fairly stagnant, if not declining on a real basis. But corporate debt also at all-time highs, and margin debt all-time highs. And so everything seems to be fully stuffed with debt at this point in time. And it feels to me like we should, that needs to be accounted for as well. Because at least when we look at like corporate earnings, and people say, oh, well, look at corporate earnings. I'm like, unless you adjust that for the debt that corporations took on to retire shares, you're not really apples to apples in this comparison. And when, not if, but when that downturn comes, that debt is now the proverbial millstone on the neck of corporate health and profitability and all that other stuff going forward. How do you, when you're looking at these things, are you factoring in, you know, the increase in debt as a as the liability it maybe is?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And of course, so this kind of goes back to some of the fundamental questions we were talking about earlier when looking at the markets. And you take a look at the amount of debt that a corporation has relative to its assets, and you know, debt to asset ratios are at all-time highs. And we shouldn't be there. But companies like Apple, who are flush with cash, have been loading up on debt to do things like buy back shares, pay dividends, because it's been a very, very efficient use of capital, because I can borrow so cheaply for 20 or 30 years. Why not borrow money at 1% and pay out a 2% dividend? That works really well over time. Well, the problem, though, is that we are leveraging up all these companies. If we take a look, and I did a study of this recently, and you combine household debt, corporate debt, government debt, combine it all together, we're at 1,100% of debt to GDP. And the important thing to remember about debt is that when you have debt, it requires service. So if I have a dollar's worth of revenue growth coming into my company, so at the top line, I earn a dollar. Well, I've got to service that debt. So that takes away from my dollar that I earned by having to service that debt. So that interest payment goes out. That means less money for me as an investor or a consumer to go reinvest capital into something productive to help for economic growth. And this is the big difference. So just recently, Donald Trump introduced his budget, and he says, okay, so here's our budget, and over the next 10 years, now, mind you, we're already 9 years into an economic cycle. Over the next 10 years, we're not going to have a recession, and economic growth is going to grow to 3%, and interest rates can remain fairly flat. Sounds fantastic. But the problem is you can't get to 3% economic growth, because back in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s, when Ronald Reagan, which is what everybody looks back to, everybody says, well, last time we did tax reform, we got this big surge in economic growth. It led to the super cycle bubble of the 80s and the 90s. Well, when that started, the average debt to household net worth was about 60%. Today, it's 140%. So back in the 60s and 70s, you had interest rates that were 14% and falling. You had inflation that was high and falling. What do you have today? Interest rates that are low and potentially nowhere to go but up. Inflation nowhere to go but obviously up or flat. So, you know, you don't have the same drivers today that you have to boost economic growth. And this is the thing that's been missed by the Fed. They keep hoping and praying that you're going to get this return to economic growth. We're going to be able to reduce leverage, and it's all going to be fine. The problem is that everybody is now subsisting solely on debt to try to make ends meet. Consumers, the reason they only have $500 in the bank is because they are tapped out to the hilt with credit card debt, not because they're buying more. So let's go back to talking about personal consumption expenditures and retail sales. If people were going in debt to buy more stuff, more iPhones, more iPads, more of this, more of that, more of everything else, then we would see personal consumption expenditures and retail sales going up, not remaining flat. We've got accelerating growth in debt, but retail sales aren't growing at the same pace because people are simply buying the same amount of stuff. They're just having to pay more for it, and they're having to pay for it on debt just to maintain their standard of living, not increase their standard of living. And that's the differential.
That is very well said. And of course, those factors that in the 60s and 70s are not going to repeat. And I'll add one more. My listeners are familiar with this, which is that during that period of time, we had rising net energy per capita flowing in. So economics is one thing, but if you understand this from the energy standpoint, rotate the cube, look at it that way, energy is everything. And a country with energy can do lots of things. A country without energy can do very few things. So having rising net energy per capita, I believe once you put that into the formula, you say, oh, I can make a case for rising standards of living. Those have been stagnant to even declining now, and I know some people are enamored. Oh, look at the shale. The Permian's amazing. But understand that now we're drilling possibly up to 5 miles of hole in order to tap into a well that might produce 250, 300, maybe 500,000 barrels over its life. But it's not a 10 million barrel or a 30 or 40 million barrel sort of a well like you could find once upon a time.
That's right.
So we're doing more to get slightly less out, and you take that friction, you start to spread that across the economy. This begins to make sense. The Fed has no clue about energy as far as I know. I don't think they have a single person over there who understands where we are in the energy story. And so speaking of oil, I know you track this, and very interesting news while we're recording this today. OPEC met last night, kind of said, hey, we're going to hold pat on the amount of cuts we already have in place. I see oil slipped pretty heavily from 52, even touched into 48. It's hanging around 49 right now. What do you make of OPEC? What do you make of their decision? And big question, is OPEC really, how important is OPEC anymore?
Well, they're still very important, despite the fact that we have shale production, you know, kind of coming out of our ears at the moment. You know, everybody's we've put $18 billion in the first quarter into drilling in the Permian Basin. You know, we are extracting oil from there, but it's only about 10% of all the total oil production we have. We still import about 6 to 7 million barrels a day from oil from overseas, just for our use here in the U.S. So we're a long way from quote-unquote energy independence, and the problem is now is that to drill offshore, you're talking about needing a price per barrel of somewhere around $60 to $70, maybe $80 to even make that a viable structure. To traditional wells need a higher level of oil than $50. They need close to $60 to make drilling traditional wells actually profitable. So right now, energy companies are piling into the shale because they can drill at $20, $25, $30 a barrel in the shale fields to create revenue. Remember, these companies, you know, these corporations don't sit around out of the goodness of their heart and just say, well, you know, we have a lot of supply, so we're just not going to drill right now, and we'll just wait for supplies to be depleted, then we'll start drilling again. Well, they won't be in business. They have employees, they have businesses, they have operating, you know, so they've got to drill regardless of what the price is. They've got to do activity to generate revenue. So what this does, though, this additional activity drags out the amount of time that we've got an oversupply of oil that we're going to have to deal with. So this supply-demand imbalance is going to take a long time to work out. And this is why when you look at the forward curves on energy, most companies here, I live in Houston, by the way, so I have a lot of contact with energy companies, and I ask the CEOs of these companies what they're doing. They're doing what they can to maintain businesses. They're drilling where they can find good opportunity at fairly low cost, and they're betting on oil being at $50 a barrel in two more years. So they're not expecting a huge recovery in oil prices, and they're simply doing what they can to maintain production right now, lower their internal costs, and you talk about automation and the impact of automation and the loss of jobs. Oil and gas companies are doing everything they can to start automating a lot of their procedures to take people out of the field and put people into central locations to monitor wells remotely using technology to lower their cost of operations. This is the future of where we are in oil and gas, and that it is going to be a very different environment going forward, and it's very likely going to be a very long time before we see tremendously higher oil prices until we resolve this supply of oil that we currently have on hand.
Well, indeed, and it's it will resolve at some point, though, because we do need that offshore. We need those larger flowing sort of well structures that are out there. But it's been fascinating to watch the shale story come out, and of course, there's some technology in that story, and then there's a lot of price reductions in that story. So if you want to know what I'm talking about, I know you do, Lance, but for people listening, just take a look at the oil services companies and their stock prices. They got killed, and they were doing everything they could to stay in business, which meant really slashing their rates when there's an uptick in the drilling activity. Look for the amounts that they can charge to go back up again, and so then we'll be having that side of the story. Boom bust, right?
I mean, that's absolutely. Well, and by the way, talking about oil companies, let me make a quick note about earnings. One of the big stories I've seen lately is, well, stock prices are going up. It's no longer about Trump. It's all about the earnings recovery story. Well, first of all, remember that we're talking about earnings recovery on a year-over-year basis. So we're comparing some positive earnings growth to negative earnings growth a year ago. So we're getting these big recovery. Earnings are up a tremendous amount from last year. Yes, because we're having earnings recovery. Where's that earnings recovery primarily coming from? From oil and gas companies, because when the price of oil bottomed and came back up, you go from basically $30 a barrel to $50 a barrel. That's almost a 75% increase in the price of oil. Tremendous boon to earnings, a big surge in the earnings for energy companies fed through to the S&P. So you're seeing this earnings recovery, but earnings have now been stagnant for an entire quarter, which means earnings growth is going to be a lot more limited over the next few quarters, which is going to potentially put at jeopardy this whole earnings recovery story. Just a side note because of oil.
All right. Well, final question here, and just to switch topics really quickly, is about real estate. I'm not sure how closely you follow this, but I'm tracking many markets, especially in Canada and Australia, clearly to me in bubbles. We're talking well over $1 million for average homes in Toronto and Sydney. Let's talk Toronto. Looks like maybe it's rolling over after posting a pretty tasty 30% gain in the past year. You know, not quite Bitcoin parabolas there, but 30% is a monster gain in real estate. Would you agree that, that sounds like an unsustainable sort of an advance? And do you think either of those markets or any other ones you might be tracking are due for a correction here?
I think housing prices in general are going to be due for a correction. And the real question is, what's driving those markets? You know, particularly in Canada, we saw a tremendous amount of money that was flowing out of China. And we saw the decline in the Chinese yuan, and we saw money flowing out. Of course, there was a lot of concern about the amount of interest rate had spiked here in the U.S. We'd gone up to 2.6%, and everybody was like, "Well, the bond bull market's over, and we're now going to go to substantially higher highs." And I wrote articles back then saying, "No, we're not. This is simply China selling bonds, because they're trying to stabilize the fall in their currency, because Chinese citizens were yanking money out of the Chinese yuan to invest it in Canadian real estate. And now they're moving into Houston real estate. They're moving into Florida real estate. So money's migrating around, but coming out of China. And that's where a lot of that initial selling of U.S. bonds came from, that had interest rates moving up. Now, subsequently, despite the bond bear story, interest rates are back down to 2.25%. And interestingly enough, despite this idea that the stock markets are off onto a new run to new highs, bonds aren't buying it. And that's something you really need to pay attention to, because bonds tell the real story. That's four times the size of the stock market. And what bonds tell you is generally that economics are not recovering, Trumponomics is not happening, and there's a real risk to stock prices going forward. But to your point specifically about real estate, I think that when you see this real estate market actually break, it's not going to be just in Canada. It's also going to be in the U.S. We have some of the same inflation and asset prices in some of the bigger areas of the country, like California, et cetera, that is going to severely impact, because a lot of those houses that were bought after 2008, they were bought by major hedge funds and turned into rental properties. And there will be a point that there will become a mass liquidation of those rental properties by hedge funds to basically capitalize on their gains, lock that in for their investors. These people aren't in the rental business. They're in the investment business. And so you get a break in the real estate market that affects into the U.S., you're going to get a net revulsion of sales.
Well, that would be a really troubling dynamic at this point. I have to say, this catches me whenever I hear, the unequivocally good that house prices have gone up. But that's not true, really. If you're a millennial who's been trying to get into a first home and got themselves priced out courtesy of Federal Reserve buying mortgage-backed securities, driving rates down, doing everything they could while Blackstone bought up huge swaths of houses that you can't afford as a millennial. That's one part of the story. The second is, if I own a house, I don't actually really want the price of it to go up if it means my insurance and property taxes go up. All I want to do is live here, right? The only people who really gain, to be clear, are the people who sell that house and then march off with that money and downsize or do something with that. It's a very tiny minority, but it's always presented as if these are unequivocally good for everybody. Not really, when you think it through.
No, absolutely not. Look, houses are an expense. If you own a house, you know this, that it's constant maintenance, taxes, repairs, upkeep. At the end of the day, we anchor on prices. Oh, I bought the house for $100,000. I sold it for $200,000. I'm a genius. Well, you go back and add up all the taxes, expenses, the repairs that you did the house, you probably lost money. And to your point, you make a very good point. People need to remember that the housing market is driven by what happens on the very fringes, the few people that are buying versus the few people that are selling versus the entirety of the market itself. And if you take a look at the housing market, and it's interesting, I just saw a commercial today, just to kind of go back to this point about debt and where we are. Take a look at auto loans and auto debt, subprime auto loans, liar loans. Those are all hiding out there. 33% of all auto loans are subprime. You take a look at student loan debt and the delinquency rates that are now coming in student loan debt. And I just saw a commercial the other day. It's like, well, we've got a program for you. If you can't afford a house and don't have the money for a down payment and don't have a job, it's okay. We can help you get a loan. Fannie Mae just lowered their qualifying requirements to a 3% down payment. We're repeating all of the very same things that we did heading up to the last real estate bubble by doing exactly the same thing again, but expecting a different outcome. The outcome won't be different.
Never is. So definition of insanity right there. We've been talking with Lance Roberts. What a fantastic interview, Lance. Thank you so much for your time today.
Sure, absolutely. Anytime. I love doing it.
All right. And please, again, tell our listeners about the best ways to follow you and your excellent work.
Well, best way to do it is simply go to our absolutely free website. It's realinvestmentadvice.com. We post something there almost every single day. We have a weekly newsletter that goes out talking specifically about kind of about market dynamics as well, investing strategies that goes on the weekends, all free. Simply go by the website, realinvestmentadvice.com. And while you're there, you can also pick up the podcast from our Real Investment Hour, which is our financially related radio program, as well as the Lance Roberts Show, which also focuses on politics and economics. And you can listen to our podcast with Chris Martinson, who we just had on just last week.
I hear he's okay. Fantastic.
Right. Good guy.
All right. Well, Lance, again, thank you so much for your time. Let's do this again soon.
Absolutely. Love to do it. Thank you.